Sessions in Depth Psychology is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. Your host is Bonnie Bright.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Discussions in Depth Psychology, which is powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute. I'm your host, Bonnie Bright, and I earned my own PhD from Pacifica in the Depth Psychology program there. And this interview series, for those of you who have been following it, you're already aware that it is dedicated to introducing you to some of the amazing individuals who are really contributing so much to this important field. And today I'm really pleased to be talking to Ray Johnson, who is a somatic movement therapist, an educator, and a researcher. And Dr. Johnson is also the chair of the Somatic Studies Specialization of the MA PhD Depth Psychology Program at Pacifica in Santa Barbara, California. Welcome, Ray. Thanks so much for being with me today.
Thanks for having me. I'm looking forward to this.
Me too. Your topic and your specialty is really fascinating and is particularly relevant to what's happening in our culture today in the United States particularly. So we're going to dig into that a little bit. But first of all, let me just read your bio, Ray, for everybody who's out there so that we can have a little bit more background on you, and then we'll jump into the conversation. Ray Johnson is the chair of the Somatic Studies Specialization of the MA PhD Depth Psychology Program at Pacifica Graduate Institute. She's a somatic movement therapist, an educator, and a researcher, as I mentioned, and she's the former chair of the Somatic Psychology Department at the Santa Barbara Graduate Institute, the former director of the Body Psychotherapy Program in the Somatic Counseling Psychology Department at Naropa University, and the founding coordinator of Student Crisis Response Programs at the University of Toronto. Her research and clinical interests include the somatic impact of oppression, embodied critical pedagogy, and feminist somatic research methods. So, Ray, I've noticed that the word founder appears a lot in your bio, and I know just from what I have read and the research that I've done in preparation for this interview that you tend to be very active and engaged in what's going on in our culture around us, and I assume that that stems from being very grounded, perhaps, in your own body, which has always been, at least for me, kind of a prerequisite for being able to do things in the outer world. So I wonder if you can start by sharing a little bit about your story, because this is not really something that I think most people would set out to become when they're younger or even in as a career path. I'm not sure that many people would think about becoming, for example, a somatic movement therapist or eventually teaching people about somatic therapy or movement work. And then I'm hoping that we can parlay that into the more activist work and writings that you've done. But let's talk a little bit about your story first, if you would share how you came to this point in your life.
Sure, of course, I'd be happy to. And I agree with you that this is not a professional path that I had charted in advance by any stretch of the imagination. It wasn't until I was well into my 30s that I even knew what somatics was. And it wasn't until I found the terms for it that I recognized what I'd been doing all along fit the term and fit the word. So one of the ways that I often like to start to talk about somatic studies and my interest in somatics as a personal practice, as a professional discipline, as an academic territory, is actually to quote Joseph Campbell, because he said something that really resonated for me. And that I've often felt this is the deeper underpinning of a somatic perspective. He said that from his perspective, he didn't actually think that we were searching for the meaning of life. He actually thought that what we were really looking for was the experience of being alive. Mm. And the distinction between the meaning of life and the experience of being alive was really salient to me. And it's that experience of being fully, completely, spontaneously, beautifully, meaningfully alive that connects me back to my body. For me, being alive is a sensory experience. And the work that I've done over the last 30 or 40 years to help me gain better access to that sensory realm, more comfortable in it, more fluent with it, and more able to engage others in that lived experience of awareness and sensory fullness really is the background of my work. And it's what I was attracted to all along, all through my life, from being a little kid and being interested in dance, but also wanting to go for long walks out in the woods and smell things and listen to things. So even though there are lots of different professional paths that I've traveled on over the course of my career, I'm registered as a social worker, I've done a lot of counseling and psychotherapy, I've studied and practiced in dance and movement therapy and education, I've done a lot of research. All of my professional interests center on that lived experience of the body. And what can we do in terms of really understanding and helping ourselves as a culture and as a species transform what it means to be truly human? How can our bodies play a role in that? How can we connect back to that very primal, grounded, deep experience of being human through the body?
Yes.
You understand how all of the things I've done actually all anchor in the same thing.
Yes, I can definitely relate to that myself as well, because certainly I've attended many workshops over the course of my own lifetime and career that have engaged somatic movement in some way or another. And for me, it has definitely been one of the most profound, transformative practices and events in my life when I have truly been able to kind of get more into my body. And I think that that's probably quite common in our culture, because our culture is really such a thinking type culture. And we spend so much time in our heads, you know, we spend so much time rationally working with things and kind of ignoring our bodies on a collective level. Now, I'm always really happy to see people that are doing yoga, you know, outside at the park. And so it really is profound for me to be able to think about how the shifts that I have made in my life through this have allowed me to engage more fully with others and to just be more at home with myself. And you mentioned a word that really struck me, and of course that's something that I'm highly interested in, and that is the word awareness. And so having this awareness of where we are in the context of things and our relationship to other people is really powerful. And I want to say a little bit more about that, but I wonder if you can just take a moment and say something about body language, both our own body language and that of others, and talk a little bit about how it gives us clues to our own basic conditioning, the belief systems that we have, and our relationship with other people around us.
Sure. I think to do that, I'm going to go back to something that you just mentioned, which is this idea that in the West, anyway, in modern Western culture, we're experiencing a philosophical legacy that has artificially disconnected the lived experience of our bodies with our cognitive capacities, with our ability to generate and work with imagery from our emotional selves, from our relationships with one another, and from a connection to our environment. And those are artificial divisions that have occurred through a very long history of, as I say, philosophical, religious, and also industrial imperatives to be a certain way. And one of the things that reconnecting with the lived experience of your body, with your breath, with your sensation, with touch, is that it also then opens up our capacity to be more in touch with all those other domains, more in touch with our feeling selves, with our emotions, with our connections with other people, with our sensory environments, with the earth. And so when you also ask about body language and how does that inform how we are with one another and how we are with ourselves, I think it's important to recognize that reconnecting with and increasing our awareness of how we speak with and through our bodies really is a reclaiming of a birthright that we have as living creatures that our culture has artificially disconnected us from. And this is very evident when we look at the research in nonverbal communication. This is mostly occurring in the field of anthropology, cultural studies. And for many, many years, we've known through this research that upwards of 75% of all of our interpersonal communication occurs on that nonverbal level. So what it means to be socialized to ignore our bodies also means that we're not consciously literate about the ways in which we're always engaging and communicating on a body level with one another, and that we've also developed these strategies for having our verbal language say things that we think are believable, but having our bodies send a very different message. And I think a lot of conflict gets exacerbated when two people are trying to share an understanding but keep getting caught up in the fact that what they're reading, what we're reading on a body level, is contradicting or in some way really complicating what we think we're communicating, because we think that what we're conveying to someone else really only ever happens on that level of the words. So absolutely, it's huge. It's huge. And particularly our emotional communication happens through our bodies. Yeah, I'm sure you can think of a dozen examples right off the bat where someone has said something like, no, I'm not angry. and their body is absolutely saying that they're angry. And we don't have a system for saying, can we both just take a moment now and just check in with our body selves and share with one another what's going on a body level? If we were able to have those kinds of conversations, if we were comfortable dropping into how we're feeling in our bodies in the presence of someone else and actually sharing from that place, I think a lot of our conflicts would resolve themselves.
I absolutely agree. Is there something that's so authentic about being able to, almost the way that I'm looking at it, is dropping back and down into our bodies and allowing ourselves to lead with that. And and for me, as I even think about that, I'm able to begin that process of just starting to come down. For me, it feels like down. It may not feel like that for everybody, but kind of down and in to a center where it's something different than, you know, that rational, head-centered sort of place where a lot of my speech seems to be coming from. And I feel that shift. And when I pay attention to it, I feel it. And so obviously, one of the very key things is that awareness, that attention, and putting attention to how it is that we are in the world and what it is that we're doing on a moment-by-moment basis. I'm sure that mindfulness can come into the conversation here. But I remember reading something in a blog that you wrote on Pacifica Post, which I really want to talk about because it was so impactful for me. And you were talking about listening with your body. And for me, that just made absolute sense when I read that, because there is a way that we obviously think about listening with our ears, but when you think about listening with your body and you feel into that, it becomes very much exactly what you were saying about how it can completely shift conversations, dynamics between two people or a group of people. I mean, I just look at the political field today and what's happening there, and it's so highly televised and broadcast on the media, and it's impossible not to notice the presidential candidates and their own body language. But I wonder if we can come back to this, and maybe you'll have a comment on that, but I wonder if we can come back to this post that is on Pacifica Post. It's called Becoming an Embodied Ally. And so if anybody wants to go back and read this later, they can go to pacificapost.com and just use the search and search Ray's name, Ray, R-A-E, Johnson, and or look for Becoming an Embodied Ally. And in this, Ray, I read this as I was starting to prepare for our conversation today, and I was reading about how you were talking about how images of violence, and particularly those that are related to racism and oppression, have affected you. And I think the very first line in that particular blog, you were talking about the systemic racism, but also the tragic deaths of Black men at the hands of police. And I literally had to go back and look at that three times to realize that you had written that in early 2015. And here we are in mid-2016, and I think the situation is worse than ever. So something is going profoundly wrong, obviously. I wonder if you can just share a little bit about your findings, what prompted you to write that post, and maybe relate it to where we are today.
Sure, yeah. There are so many different threads that get woven into what you're raising here in terms of how are our bodies implicated in issues of social justice. One of the things that's really clear from the research, but also from the work in the field of people doing trainings and education around diversity and equity and inclusivity, is that depending upon your social identifications, depending on what you look like or where you were born or what family you were born into or what culture you were born into, what your social position is, that we treat one another across those social differences very differently. I think in many cases, those inequities, those differences in treatment, that unfair, unequal access to resources and to privilege happens on a systemic level, on an institutional level, on the level of legislation. But it also happens on the level of the body. And I think we've done less work and are less tuned into how we perpetuate those unequal and inequitable interpersonal relationships through how we engage one another on a body level. And one of the ways that that happens is that we allow some members of some groups access to kinds of nonverbal behaviors that members of subordinated social groups don't have access to. And I'll just give you a couple of examples from the scholarly literature because they're really compelling. One of the things that the research is telling us is that people who hold a lot of privilege and who are socially dominant have the right to touch people who are in socially subordinated positions that those socially subordinated individuals don't have the right to reciprocate or to refuse. So perhaps the most basic example that our listeners maybe would understand is a man exercising the privilege to pat a female employee on the shoulder or to touch her arm. And that female employee, both because she's female and women in this culture are still not given access to the same kinds of privileges as men are, and because this person is an employee, not the boss, that socially subordinated individual does not have the same right to reach out and touch her boss on the shoulder. We know this. If the example is brought to our attention, we go, oh, yeah, no, that would be really, wow, I'd get in trouble if I tried that. We get that. We understand it intuitively, and immediately we all agree on it. But those kinds of, and I'm going to use a particular word that's being used in this field now, these kinds of microaggressions that happen on a body level are cumulative, and people who live lives that are mostly outside the margins of society, who live lives in ways that don't give them access to the privileges that others enjoy, experience these kinds of embodied microaggressions every day, that people won't look them in the eye, or they're not allowed to make eye contact, they're not allowed to take up very much space, their bodily behavior is suspect and put under scrutiny. And those are some of the things that I think that happen in these really tragic interactions between police officers who are not only socialized but trained to carry their bodies, to carry themselves in a particular manner, and to exude and exert a particular kind of physical presence and authority. And members of marginalized community, whether they're people with a chronic mental illness or people of color or disabled people or poor people or homeless people, people who don't have the kinds of resources and social privileges that many other people in this society enjoy. They're coming from this place of having been aggressed upon all their lives. And quite literally, what we're discovering is that they're also experiencing trauma, that oppression is traumatic, and that the trauma of being continually worn down by the little tiny paper cuts of embodied microaggressions throughout their lives has the same kinds of post-traumatic stress effects that we're seeing in returning war veterans. So it's a volatile mix. When you have an individual who's trained to embody authority in a particularly strong, emphatic, privileged, and rigid way, and someone who's experiencing trauma because they're a member of an oppressed group.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense when you explain it that way. And I was experiencing visuals throughout the entire few minutes that you were speaking there. And of course, one of the first things that came to my mind, and then you mentioned it later, was homeless people, because that's somebody that I see on a daily basis. There's a lot of homelessness where I live. And I am constantly aware, I think, of that kind of issue. And I remember reading a long time ago in some self-help book or another that even if you can't offer something to homeless people or to people who are struggling or having challenges, that one thing you can always do is send them a silent blessing or something mental to aid them in some way. And of course, it makes me wonder, as I think about that now, having heard what you've had to talk about, if that isn't also just one more way that I, as a more privileged person, because I have what I have, maybe interacting in a way that is not necessarily appropriate, even if it's all I feel that I can do. So I think the problem is systemic. And I wonder how you go about changing a system that is so broken when even people who want to be aware and conscious of it and want to do something to help maybe don't necessarily know what to do and fall back on these same kinds of processes and techniques that we have been so socialized into, as you point out.
Yep. I think the problem is complex, and I think the solution also needs to be complex and multifaceted. So what I'm about to say, please don't hear this as something that I think of as a single solution to a very complex problem, but one of the things that is so heartening and hopeful and affirming for me in doing somatic work is that I really do think it makes a difference. And I believe that it makes a difference on that individual body-to-body level that we so tend to ignore. So you offer this lovely example of when I am walking down the street and I pass a homeless person to send them a silent blessing. What I might add to that is that a willingness to walk past that homeless person with a soft posture, to not walk around and skirt around them sitting on the sidewalk as if they were contagious. If they look at you, to not be afraid to make eye contact, to smile, to acknowledge them as a human being through your nonverbal behavior, makes such a difference in terms of them having the experience in their bodies, in their lives, of being recognized as a full human being. It takes 2 seconds. So hard to do because we're socialized to be afraid, and when we're afraid, we contract. And we won't look, and we won't smile, and we won't move, and we won't come close.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the daily experience of people living on the streets, is that no one will engage them. No one will offer them kindness and connection and reassurance, even for 2 seconds as they're walking by. It's a small example, but I think learning the skills to recognize what you're doing on a body level and asking yourself the question, is this how I want to be in the world? Is this how I want to engage my fellow human beings? That then gives you an opportunity to say, what do I need in my own body? What reassurance or resource or strength or affirmation do I need for myself so that I can be with this other human being in a way that actually conveys to them the values that I hold about all human beings, being worthy of respect and dignity and being equal?
Yeah, that's so profound. I really appreciate that you are engaging on this topic, Ray, because I think for a lot of us, it's even hard to have conversations around it. You know, I find myself watching the news and seeing what's happening with these police killings, and I know that there's not a simple solution either, and I know that is not the only one thing that can be done, but I'm just imagining how our entire social system would be completely different if all of our civil servants, and all of us, in fact, were trained on some level to have that contact with our own bodies, and therefore when we come into contact with anybody, whether it's the police with a potential perpetrator or even an innocent person who they've pulled over, or somebody else that we meet on the street, it becomes a very different way of engaging with the other because we have somehow managed to engage with ourselves. And I think a lot of us look at our bodies, and well, it's not a rational thing, but a lot of us probably feel on some level that our bodies are other because just the simple fact of being in a body on this planet is a very unique and unusual thing that we completely take for granted.
Yeah. we have been othered from our own bodies through the ways in which we're socialized.
Yeah, yeah, that's absolutely true. And I'd actually like to take this one step further and dig into a little bit what I'm very interested in personally. And that is, you had mentioned the word trauma and how, you know, people are traumatized by all of these little things that happen day in and day out. And I can definitely see that in myself, in people that are around me, people that I come in contact with. And I'm also interested in how, because of what's going on in our culture, because of the way that we are so inundated by media on a regular basis and we hear all of these horrible things that are happening to us, and because we are all aware on some level of what's happening to the planet, how destructive our culture is, the mass extinctions that are beginning to happen and that we're predicting for future, and all of these things I think are perceived as trauma by our bodies, literally, because how can we exist in a world where we know that our demise is imminent and, by the way, we might be contributing to that very profoundly in just the way of life that we have, and we can't change the system. So I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on how, just on a daily basis, that each one of us can concretely engage in more of a somatic way of being in the world to be able to manage and mitigate some of the trauma that we're experiencing on an unconscious and conscious level.
Yep, it's a great question. So I mentioned some research that demonstrates that there's a correlation between oppression and trauma, and that people who experience not a single incident, acute traumatic incident, but a number of smaller insults, tiny injuries, things that happen that are just, they just accumulate to the point where, on a body level, the effect is as if there were a single profound trauma. So we need to talk a little bit about trauma response to really unpack this. We need to recognize, at least in terms of our current understanding of post-traumatic stress, is that our bodies respond to traumatic events in ways that absolutely override our cognitive capacities, that it's not something that we can think ourselves into or out of, that our nervous system responds as a survival mechanism when we experience being threatened. And we need to be able to recognize how that looks. And one of the things that happens is that our nervous systems become highly aroused. And if it happens often enough, or if the threat doesn't go away, our nervous systems actually become dysregulated in such a way that we are chronically over-aroused. And our nervous systems are working way harder than they need to, or ought to, or way harder than they're designed to. And that there can be accompanying both hypervigilance, really going through the world in a way that acts as if it's very unsafe, even when it is safe, because it's our chronic sort of pattern to be alert and to feel under threat. The other thing that happens when we're traumatized is that we experience constriction and we have less access to emotions, to attitudes, to behaviors than we would otherwise. And that because of that, because the circumstances and the times that we're living in actually, I think, collude to give all of us an experience of being under threat, that one of the things that we can do on a body level is to recognize and to feel into, how's my nervous system right now? How's my heart rate? How's my breathing? Is it high and shallow? Or am I taking nice, deep, diaphragmatic breaths? Oh, it's high and shallow. Oh, okay, so maybe I could do something to just take a nice, easy breath and to take a slow exhale. And maybe I'll do that again. And as I do that, maybe I'll reconnect to my sense of having my feet on the ground. That very awareness and that very simple exercise involving breath can help our nervous systems self-regulate and counter the effects of living in a world where we feel under threat. So there are lots
I'm practicing that
very
now.
Practical. There are lots of really practical skills that somatic work teaches us. That's just one of them, centering and grounding, but also increasing our expressive movement repertoire so that we can be really sophisticated and literate and expressive with our own communication with ourselves and with other people. All kinds of things that everyone can learn to reclaim that fluency and vibrancy and responsiveness that feeling traumatized takes away.
Yeah. I, as you talk, I can really feel it. And I was practicing that breathing process that you were mentioning as you were describing it. And it definitely, again, just grounds you, drops you right into your body when you do that. And so it's such a simple and quick way to do that. So no matter what kind of situation you're in, it's something that we all have access to at any given time. So it feels like a really powerful tool to be able to do that.
I was just going to say that tool is actually even more powerful than what I've just described, because I don't need to talk you through how to do that in order for you to get the benefits of it. All I need to do, if I'm in interaction with someone who's freaking out or stressed or upset or anxious, all I need to do is to take that breath myself. Because we're wired, we have neurological structures that hook us into what's happening on a body level with the person in front of us, with the person that we're engaged with and looking at. And when I take that nice, deep, grounding breath, you do too.
True.
We don't even need to talk about it. All we need is somebody in the room who's willing to take the breath.
That's just great.
Yeah.
Wow, that is something that will stay with me for a long time. That's
great.
Very, very good. And I hope that everybody who's listening to this right now is breathing along with us and able to feel that. And I suspect that they are. It's very almost contagious in a way. And you're right, it's something that we can control for our own selves. And yet that kind of reverberates out into whatever situation or dynamic we find ourselves in. You know, I imagine that the students in the somatic studies specialization, where you're the chair at Pacifica, are exposed to some of these same kinds of tenets and insights in their coursework there. I'm wondering if you can just share for our last couple of minutes a little bit about what they are learning. And also, I know that field work is a requirement for students there. What kinds of field work are they getting into, and what kinds of things are they studying and ending up doing with their careers once they graduate?
One of the things that I love about this program is that because we're not a clinical license eligible program, because we don't train psychotherapists or counselors, we have the freedom both to have students come into the program who are doing very, very interesting and diverse work. So we attract students, some of whom are already counselors, but who are also public school teachers and occupational therapists and nurses and fiction writers and organizational consultants and social workers. And what we do in this program is that we provide them with the foundational knowledge and skill in depth psychology and in somatic studies. And we help them develop strategies for applying that work and that knowledge to their particular professional area of interest and expertise. So our field work projects are very diverse and very creative. One student went out and studied interspecies embodiment with rescue elephants in Cambodia. We talked about it as interspecies intercorporeality. And it sounds like a very fancy term, but once we recognized that that's what he was doing, it also allowed him to realize how much he'd learned about the theoretical conceptual frameworks underlying his impulse to go and be with elephants to understand what kind of body-to-body communication might be possible. We've got students who are interested in using homeopathy to treat autism. We've got students who are looking at embodied archetypes in substance abuse treatment. Students who are doing field work around the use of yoga with sex trade survivors in India. It's another student who did work with mandalas at the Los Angeles courthouse with children who are waiting to testify. The applications and the possibilities are endless. What they all have in common is that all of our students understand that because of the ways in which our culture currently operates, most human endeavors are missing two key components. One is a recognition of the unconscious and the power of archetype and image and dream and imagination. And the other is a dismissal of the body and the richness of the senses and the capacity of the body to return us to a very empathetic sense of being with human beings who share a lot of our same concerns, conditions, and experiences. So all of our fieldwork projects that students do have those two things in common, is that they've found a way in their own fields, in their own professional work, to bring both body and soul into those places.
That is so powerful, and it almost gives me a sense of relief, Ray, to realize that this kind of program is available and that people are actually engaging in it and then taking that out into the world. I mean, all of those examples that you mentioned, I was writing them down as you were mentioning them because I just thought, gosh, I want to know more about that, and I want to know more about that. So it's really wonderful, and I'm just so grateful for the work that you're doing there as the chair of the Somatic Studies program, and also to the students who are engaging in that and enriching their own careers, but also just bringing so much to our culture when we're so greatly in need of this exact kind of enrichment and being able to get more in touch with that sense of our own embodiment. So it's really wonderful.
It's a wonderful program to teach in, and it's remarkably nourishing to be in the presence of students who have that kind of commitment to transform what it means to be human in the world.
Beautiful. Well, thank you so much, Ray. I've been speaking with Ray Johnson, who is a somatic movement therapist, educator, and researcher, and who is also the chair of the Somatic Studies program in the MA PhD Depth Psychology program at Pacifica Graduate Institute in Santa Barbara. Ray, thank you so much for being with me today.
You're very welcome. It was my pleasure.
You've been listening to Discussions in Depth Psychology, powered by Pacifica Graduate Institute with host Bonnie Bright.